Welcome to Wisdom.MBA, a podcast where I interview business school students, professors, and alums, as well as industry thought leaders. We like to share wisdom, focusing on the hard lessons learned through different career and business endeavors, and share insights into how you can put a business school education to best use. For this podcast, I interview Chris McElroy, who is the founder and CEO of Knox Provisions, a company which has reinvented binoculars. Chris is a successful entrepreneur with a proven track record of designing disruptive products and bringing them to market. Prior to Knox, Chris was the head of product and the co-founder of Boombotic, one of the original Bluetooth personal speaker brands to enter the market. Chris helped scale that business from $200K to over $13 million in annual revenue. We discussed the lessons learned from massive growth, raising venture capital, and what it was like partnering with Wu-Tang. Chris and I discuss product development, prototyping, and why product market fit is so critical. He shares his insights on how to bootstrap a business idea and talks about the importance of finding your MVB, minimum viable business. He shares his advice for overseas manufacturing and how to disrupt established markets with highly innovative designed products. If you like product development, direct-to-consumer marketing, and design, then I'm sure you'll love this episode. Chris, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I love starting off with icebreakers, and you got some pretty cool ones here. So with Boombotic, you got to work with the Wu-Tang Clan. So who is your favorite member, and just also how did that relationship start?
Well, man, it was definitely the coolest thing to happen to me in my career up until that point. Wu-Tang is like, I'd listened to them for ages and downloading them off LiveWire or whatever, back in the day. And so when we were working at Boombotics, we ultimately were creating these Bluetooth speakers that were ultra portable, clip on, the first kind of like wearable Bluetooth speaker. And we had a rep out in Brooklyn, super cool guy. You know, he was out there and he was also repping for Burn Helmets. And Burn did like the Wu brand collab. So Wu-Tang had licensed their W out to this brand that was just putting it on t-shirts, whatever. And they did a helmet with them. And so our guy's like, dude, it'd be cool if we did a Boombotics, Wu-Tang, that'd be pretty cool. We're like, all right, we're all in. And so we went along the path with the Wu brand. And again, it's like a licensing kind of group, some guys in New York, no one really notable. And after a few weeks of that discussion, it turned out that RZA had heard about this. And was like, yo, if you guys are doing anything audio related, I need to be involved. Like, this isn't just a t-shirt. Like, I need to see what's up with this. So we sent him a speaker and he got the speaker and was just like, yo, what if we put the music in the speaker? It's like everyone's streaming this and that, but what if we put the music into the speaker? And he came back to us and we were like, what? Oh my goodness. Like, you're interested? And he's like, yeah. So he was on board to do this through the Wu-Tang Clan proper and put the music in the speaker. And so, it was probably a few, weeks of negotiation. And the next thing we have, as we're finalizing a deal with RZA to basically come on board as our creative abbot, I'm sitting out there like deep in Shaoguan, China, like not Shenzhen, but like 5 hours inland from there at the factory, engineering a new board for the speaker to have to basically hold the album in the speaker. And so redesigned the firmware. And I'm sitting out there in Shaoguan with a Dropbox link to an unreleased Wu-Tang album, just by myself going, holy cow, I can't believe that I've got I'm like one of the only people in the world with an unreleased Wu-Tang album, and, loaded them onto the speaker. And that holiday, it was probably June when we started talking, and that, November, we shipped 3,000 units of this amazing Wu-Tang Boombotics product that had a better tomorrow embedded into the speaker. So it worked normally as Bluetooth, but it also was embedded on there. And, the Wu fans just were so excited about it. And it was just, that was a really, really cool product to kind of build and, from idea to shelf in like 6 months. It was crazy.
Well, you had a huge amount of responsibility given that I think they have that one of one vinyl record that went for many millions of dollars. So it sounds to me that RZA is your favorite. Mine's ODB.
ODB. ODB was definitely, I think, one of my favorites. And then GZA, GZA's, Liquid Swords album is like just a lyrical masterpiece. And I really love, you know, he's just such a vocabularist. I don't know, but after all of that, it was so cool to work with RZA. And yeah, I mean, we ended up designing headphones together, and he spent a lot of time in the office, and I was working with RZA on product development. And yeah, just so cool to meet him. And, you know, it's like one of your idols, and then all of a sudden you're working with him, and you're like going out for drinks, and just, it was so dope to be connected to someone who's just such like a, just on another level. So yeah, after all said and done, Uncle Bobby, RZA, definitely favorite member.
Well, speaking of idols and other levels, one project that I worked on, and this is an icebreaker, so we can make it about me a little bit too, is the commander of the International Space Station, Chris Hadfield. He's a Canadian. He also is a musician. And I reached out to his people because we wanted to print his images from space. And it took months and months. And I finally got a hold of his son, who managed his Twitter account, which he was posting stuff from low orbit. And he's like, yeah, he's just working right now on a music cover and also a lot of his research before he comes back into orbit. Well, the music cover was the first ever music video shot from space in the International Space Station. And it was a cover of David Bowie's, it's not Rocket Man, but it'll come to me. Anyways, but it blew up on the internet. And then finally, when he came back to terrestrial Earth, and after months of, you know, recouping, he's like, yeah, we'll do a licensing agreement. So we got the exclusive to his images from space. So same thing, we got a hard drive, and we had to color correct all these photos from space. And it was this giant, like, logistical challenge, because it's like, well, who owns it? He took the photos, but it was also in the International Space Station. So there's different jurisdictions. But that was a 2.5 year project from like idea to actually making it happen. And sure enough, he came to our factory and got to meet him. So really rewarding. So this is a motivator to anyone out there. Dream big, find your idols, and find out ways to do licensing agreements, because you never know what could happen. You could be, you know, grabbing drinks with Wu-Tang, or in my case, you know, one of the coolest astronauts on the face of the planet.
Oh man, that's so cool. Yeah.
Not to one up you. I don't think I one up no. But it's like, you know.
No, I mean,
when you're in this space, you get to have these cool partnerships from time to time.
Totally. Isn't that what this is about? No, I'm just kidding. But it was really insightful, and just like, again, like these people are, they're just people. And I mean, I feel like our culture really worships celebrities as if they know something that we don't, but hanging out, you're like, man, we're all kind of the same here, you know, and you happen to work hard and choose something unique and build your own personal brand, and you got a big following. But at the end of the day, like, we're all people. Side note, after Boombotics for about 6 months, I worked at this company called Yonder, and they create these phone free spaces by putting people's phones into.
Oh, I love couches. Yonder. Oh, they're amazing.
Yeah. It's an amazing company. I mean, just the whole entire production. And I got lucky to be able to work there on product. And it was by far the hardest product I've ever had to work on, because most of the stuff we make, people take care of. But this was like designing a thing that's, you know, cheap, simple to use, easy, you know, easy enough to produce and travel with, but also like high school kids, you're holding their phone hostage. Like, they're trying to destroy these. So it was certainly the hardest product. But out of all of that, Dave Chappelle was one of the, you know, kind of the early people supporting that business. And, you know, got to hang with Dave Chappelle shortly after that RZA thing. And it was just, again, another one of like, wow, like, you are another one of my idols. And it's just so cool to just go hang out and just kind of be a human with them, and realize that we're all pretty, you know, everyone is pretty special in their own right, even if they don't have a monstrous following or a TV show.
Yeah, but you made me think of Christopher Walken on Saturday Night Live when he plays Bruce Dickens, and he says, "Hey guys, I put my pants on just like the rest of you, one leg at a time, except when my pants are on, I make gold records." So mean, in the context of like Wu-Tang and Chris Hadfield, when his pants are on, he happens to be in space. So yeah, they're just like us, but they also make gold records. So moving along now, I want to talk about business programs for entrepreneurs. So fun fact, one of my first podcast guests was a fellow Loyola Marymount alumni, who's also a very successful entrepreneur and product developer. His name's Ted Barker, and he's a co-founder of Kalo, which are these synthetic rings that are now ubiquitous. He was the first. He invented it. But your journeys are very similar, and you were featured in an LMU website for alumni, and you talked about how it gave you, you know, the tools to succeed. So what was that course like? And it sounds to me like so far I've met two very successful entrepreneurs have come out of that program that have designed amazing products. Would you recommend it to others? And what was it like?
That's a great question. I mean, to be quite honest with you, the Cliff Notes was, I was never one of those kids in high school who like started a, you know, a garage cleaning business and made, you know, my college tuition before I got to college. Like, you know, I worked in a bike shop growing up, and when I got to college, I was studying finance and realized like in the business program at LMU studying finance and was like, all right, well, you know, this is cool, but it's kind of like keeping score. I want to be, you know, putting points on the board. So you switch to marketing, and through marketing, you know, you learn a lot of generic stuff like distribution, different kind of pricing tactics, advertising, international marketing, but it was all pretty like surfacey and, you know, kept searching. And I felt like my journey there was this search of, well, what else is there? And I took some art classes and learned like, you know, the Adobe suite, and ended up in the learning entrepreneurship. It was kind of a triple emphasis. And in that entrepreneurship program, I mean, this is my second semester senior year. Everyone's checked out. And I just remember seeing the light at the end of the tunnel going, oh man, college is almost over. And this class that David Choi, who I believe is the head of the entrepreneurship, he's definitely the head of the entrepreneurship department. I think he is the head of the business school at this point. He created this class of the Otis School of Design, and it just clicked. It was so cool to learn about industrial design and product design. I had no idea after all those years. And that class, we the business kids went to Otis School of Design to learn from the industrial design professors. And the design kids went to the Loyola Marymount to learn, you know, the core business curriculum. And it blew my mind. I remember watching Objectified for the first time and just hearing about how, you know, everything that exists is designed by someone. And, you know, that door handle that you can't figure out, or that one thing that you can't figure out, it's not your fault. It's bad design. And I just ended up, it blew my mind. I looked all over and realized, wow, that could be better. That could be a lot cooler. And, you know, we did a fun project there, but really it was that exposure to product, which I feel like exists in a silo outside of a business curriculum. And so for LMU to bring in that sort of product design philosophy into business, I mean, you sit in front of a computer all day, but whatever you're doing, whatever the business is, it exists in the real world. So it was a tremendously important class, and really it segued really well into the fact that a friend who I grew up skiing with, Leif Storr, I grew up skiing with Leif, and he had started this business kind of as an engineer. He created a little speaker out of a Japanese vinyl toy and was able to bike around with it. He sent me a prototype. And so it all kind of connected at that point when I had something to actually think about that was relevant coming out of that class. And, it was quite a springboard to graduate and have this sort of new desire, this new understanding of like everything I had just learned in business, the finance, the marketing, to tie that together with product was just, I mean, I couldn't be happier with my time at Loyola Marymount, even though it did feel like I was, you know, I wasn't necessarily like on that track to begin with. It was kind of a surprise.
Great. And then, so Boombotic, was that born out of the program?
No. So Boombotics was born out of Leif's wild mind. And he had created this Japanese, it was a Japanese vinyl toy, and he was an artist painting these vinyl toys, and he had one, and one of his coworkers, he's a few years older, one of his coworkers said, "Hey man, is that a speaker?" And he looked at it and was like, "No." But then went home that night and took an iHome apart and put the iHome speaker into the vinyl toy, and he made about 12 of them. And it was honestly, I mean, we're talking 2010. This was the coolest thing. I'd skateboard through campus with my iPod plugged into the speaker, skating through campus, and all these just random, you know, random kids would be like, "Woo, I love Deadmau5," like as I'm skating through. And it was just such a cool experience. And so Leaf got that going, and I ended up graduating. I took a couple of like, just my prospect was like low level sales jobs. And after a few of those, in early 2011, I joined Leaf up in San Francisco. And the first thing I said was, "Well, this product's really cool. It's this skull looking Japanese vinyl toy, really kind of wild looking, that had like an audience that dug it." But it looked, basically there was a day where I was selling them and people would go, "Oh, what's this thing?" And I'm like, "Well, it's a Bluetooth speaker. It's clip-on, it's rugged, it's colorful, it's got the volume control built in, we're a cool brand." And they'd go, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." Like every point they're stoked. But then they would look at it and they'd go, "Okay, man, see ya." And I just remember going, "Well, if it just did all the same things, but if it looked like cooler," you know, that's kind of what my intuition was telling me. These people were stoked on the features, but they would look at it and then they would walk away. So taking that, you know, product, having that product design mentality, and also having Leaf, having gotten in there and set up a factory relationship, he had sold about, you know, 1,000 units or so at this time. I was able to like plug into the factory, start designing, start sketching, taught myself some CAD programs, and then worked with a factory to basically bring this product to life, which was kind of the workhorse product of the brand called the Rex.
Yeah. And so you scaled the business to ship over, you know, 250,000 units per year and revenue from 200K to 13 million, which is extremely commendable. Congratulations. And I believe you guys launched on Kickstarter. Is that correct?
Well, we launched out of the back of Leaf Subaru, technically, okay. You know? But ultimately for me, this was sort of my like grad school project, you could say. I designed this product. It was one of the first speakers with Siri integration built in. So, you know, you could talk to it. And I just thought, man, Kickstarter, like 2012, Kickstarter was hot. And we were going to tell the whole story through Kickstarter. So for this product, we launched it on Kickstarter, and we had we had kind of the basics of, we had a brand that existed, we had an audience that was engaged. And so with those two things, we had enough people to put eyes on it and enough and a way to get press around the product. Remember those days when you could do a Kickstarter and get TechCrunch and Fast Company? So we launched that thing on Kickstarter, and that process really looked like, you know, obviously designing the product, shooting a lot of photography, and then telling the story through the video. And so the video really was like a 30-second snippet about the brand, where we were, you know, a minute, or actually no, 30-second like sizzle reel about showing the product on bikes, on skis, going surfing, traveling, like a minute about the development of the product, and then a minute about the brand and who we were as a team in the mission in San Francisco. And it really felt like that was kind of like a sort of grad school project out of a garage in the mission in San Francisco.
Yeah. And then you translated that in 2012 into closing a Series A round led by Walden VC. What was the early investment thesis for investors? Like, what did they like about the product and the company? Or was it more the industry?
Well, it was an amazing experience to, again, be in a garage building this thing. And when we would show up, you know, all over, and we were at the SF Music Tech Conference, I got up, I did the 1 minute, you know, the 1 minute entrepreneur pitch, because there were some investors in the room, and, you know, went up there and just turn the thing up. They sound louder than they look. And the Brian Zisk, who ran the conference, he also like loved the brand. He had some product he was able to vouch. And one of the guys in the room was Larry Marcus at Walden. And he came up to us after and was interested to chat. And I think the interesting thing at that point in 2012 was, I think this, yeah, this was 2012, was the sort of new, like this hardware 2.0, right? We had just kind of exited the app ecosystem, you know, apps for everything. And I think that was pretty saturated. And, you know, hardware was pretty hot. And here we were like creating a wearable, buzzword, wearable Bluetooth speaker that had integrations into Siri. Leaf is quite a technologist as well. So we were developing apps to sync music playback over multiple speakers. And I think that that was a big part of this was it was a physical product. We had our, you know, we had our stuff figured out. We were able to be shipping. It wasn't some VC investing in our, you know, prototype. So yeah, it was great to get Larry on board and a few others for that kind of initial investment.
So when you launched, there was not a lot of competitors, but like pretty quickly, there's JBL, Sonos, Beats, you name it, like so many Bluetooth speakers on the market. If you could go back and do things differently, what would you change, if anything?
Oh man, this was such an important learning. When we launched, we were the pioneer. There was no other wearable Bluetooth speaker. There was the Jawbone Jambox, and we set our sights on that. We made it sound better, or not, we made it sound louder in a smaller enclosure. So it was great, but there were not a lot of competitors. And so what I would do differently is sort of the like art of war style of, you know, just imagining like, shoot, if there were competitors, what would they do? How would they show up? And we didn't think that. We built this cool product. We had a cool brand. We were on all the bike messengers. We were sold really well into like the cycling channel, but we had one real product and that doesn't command a lot of gravity on the shelf. It's true. JBL came in with their little clip. You know, Sonos kind of came into it differently with a more at-home situation. But again, Bose eventually made a wearable speaker. Beats came out with a pill. And if I could go back and change things, I think what we should have done, I mean, immediately following the success of this new design language was expanding the product line. So expanding distribution while expanding the product line. I think we had product market fit. We had that lightning in a bottle. And really, I think what we did was sat back and continued with that, and that playbook that got us to that point, which was being cool, being core, being, you know, a unique sort of brand. Really, I'd say, I don't want to say overvaluing brand, but being like a little defensive about the brand and, you know, really wanting to create the coolest kind of thing ever without one, trying to scale it into a wider audience. And then two, I really think that's dictated by the product line. So, you know, if I could go back and do things differently, I think we would have taken that, you know, what we did is we took this product and we went, okay, it's cool. Well, how can we, you know, improve the product? How can we make a 2.0 version of it? And I think at that point, the right thing to do would be to create a good, better, best speaker product line, maybe a boom box, really widen the product line, because ultimately that would allow us to create a revenue opportunity for our wholesale distributors or our wholesale distribution that would be more meaningful than being like, hey, we have this really cool product. And like bike shops would love it. We have the one thing. But I think in order to have scaled distribution to create that revenue opportunity, we should have really just run with a broader product line.
Yeah, what I like researching for this and looking at your entrepreneurial journey is that Knox now feels like the antithesis of the experience that you went through, where you raised a bunch of capital, you moved quick. You were an early adopter on a rapidly expanding industry. But now with Knox, it's like, it's a more slow, methodical, you know, really heavily design focused innovation in a very established market. So, you know, it started as your passion project, and I believe you worked on it for almost 2 years. You know, you've bootstrapped the business, you know, you built out multiple prototypes beforehand. So just talk to us a little bit about the initial inspiration for Nox, and like, were you intentional about, hey, taking all your learnings from Boombotics and sort of pivoting your strategy for Nox?
Absolutely. You know, I, the whole Boombotics journey, again, it was more than just that 2012, 2013. We did raise another round of financing. We did eventually grow the product line. We brought on more experienced management. I had gone to China 20 times. We ended up building a good, better, best headphone line, a good, better, best speaker line, full display, you know, for in store. We shipped into Verizon stores, T-Mobile, one incarnation of Radio Shack or another. We really did end up scaling that thing correctly when we brought in the new management. But again, at that point, it was too late. At that point, like, we were more in a trench war with JBL and some of these other players. And, you know, people had realized the market potential, and there were a lot of like cheap kind of Amazon products. So we did eventually do that. And in that process, you know, everyone would say, hey man, this is such great experience for you. And I'm like, okay, thank you. You know, your Facebook salary is like more than I've ever made in my like career. You know, thanks for the kind words. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, sure enough, getting Nox going, all of that experience played in. I mean, all of it. And it really was such valuable experience. It felt like kind of an MBA, like on the, an MBA slash like PhD, you could say, whatever. That all played into Nox. And so getting into Nox, you know, I realized that its business is hard. It's really hard. It's romanticized. It's all Shark Tanked up, but it's hard. I mean, having your idea, going from idea to a little prototype or a product is cute and motivating. Okay, good for you. But once you actually start shipping and you make this your career, and it's not easy. It's a lot of work, and it's considerable. It's just an uphill battle. And so with Nox, it was a great idea. It was a fun, you know, idea, and a fun idea that we tossed around as a kind of what a brand could be. A roommate at the time, Kyle Parsons, he's the founder of Indosol Sandals. He came back from a music festival and was like, man, if only we had some cool, like stylish binoculars. And that was kind of where the idea originated from. And at that time I was kind of between jobs and researching what the space looked like, and realized, wow, yeah, the space, these brands are pretty boring. And they're really, we tried out a few products and realized that there are a lot of big, expensive binoculars that were really great, and then a lot of small, cheap ones that were just garbage. And there really wasn't anything in the middle. So, you know, the idea, it was kind of an initial idea, and ended up taking that job at Yonder. And shelving it, and then took another job in tech and really shelved it. But eventually, a few years later, it came out as this, you know, visiting friends in Bali, seeing them run, you know, international businesses off the island was so cool, and thought, all right, let's give this binocular thing a go. So ultimately, yeah, I was thinking about this just prior to our interview, but the beginning of Nox was like an art project. It was really, I was pushing myself to see what kind of design I could come up with, pushing to find a factory that I could work with. But this design process was really an art project. I didn't tell anyone about it. It was really just my own thing, and worked really hard on it, and got to the point where I had created a few prototypes, and then a few off-tool product samples, and really just did the absolute minimum. The product, the packaging, didn't even have a website, didn't have an Instagram. Just really focused on the product, and started noticing that friends in the neighborhood in the Outer Sunset in San Francisco would be like, oh man, these are so cool. Like, I want one of these. And And, you know, another kind of artist in the neighborhood was like, hey, man, can I have your prototype? At that point, I should have known. But really, from that point on, it was almost like you draw a line in the sand and you say, okay, you poured yourself into this idea, this product, this concept, the brand. And again, it was all done as like a minimum viable product, just creating product, packaging, website, like made an Instagram handle, whatever. But then after that, it was switching gears into going, okay, well, now you need to be very objective and dispassionate. Is this thing going to work? Does this have real potential? Does anyone care that you're making this? And starting to think about, it really was a big shift, because ultimately the last thing you want to do is pour your life for 4 or 5 years into creating your vision, and the vision not actually having traction. And it's a lot easier to just have a full-time job and do artwork on the side and not worry about selling a binocular unit by unit.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, because you talked about entrepreneurship being hard, and it certainly is. But I think that I want to convey is that it's hard relative to like the safer paths. It's like, yeah, you can go get a job at Meta, you can get a stable paycheck. And I've had this conversation with tons of entrepreneurs that's like, you know, in some cases the path is just, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. And to your point, it's like, really find that product. If you're going to devote your time, energy, and capital into something, find out pretty quickly whether or not it's worth your time. So your process is, you know, starting off with this entrepreneurial hypothesis in that there was a gap in the market between like entry level crappy kids toys binoculars versus like the super high end. So I'll just wait for that there. So obviously a huge gap, and then prototyping essentially very quickly the minimum viable product. We studied that in a course called Entrepreneurial Execution as part of the MBA. It's like, how quickly can you validate a product and see whether or not it has traction in the market or not? So, I mean, you did the skunk works. You said, you know, initial product, you know, packaging and Instagram channel. So talk a little bit more about like, was that intentional? Is that something that you learned in school? Or was that just like, hey, I want to be mindful of my time and I don't want to waste on something that I don't think is going to work. I need to prove this out quickly. Like, what was your motivator for figuring out that product market fit quickly?
You know, the motivator was, I think, the experience. You know, having done that Boombotics Kickstarter, that was like, I was ready to, you know, work on that or bust. Like, that was my, I needed to create a thing and needed to see it go out into the world and own. It was pretty like anal about every part of the process, from the product to the marketing. But going back to being a little deeper in your career, you know, you don't want to be stuck in the trenches for years trying to get something to work, because it does feel like you really have one chance to get something out. And so again, it was like, I think that along those lines of like the minimum viable product to test the market, right? On one hand, yes, you do need to create a product. If you share your idea with people and you let that be the point of sort of, if it's ideas are too fragile to be even be shared. If you think it's a great idea, you can talk to a few people, do your research, but you don't need to share that with your idea with people, because people don't really get it. There was a guy who worked with us at Boombotics who was like a surf rep. And I remember he was saying like, man, we tried selling binoculars, but like they don't really sell like in surf shops. And I remember being like, okay, well, whatever. I'm still building this thing. And it turns out they sell really well at surf shops. But also the minimum viable product can't be shit. Pardon my language, but you know, on the other hand, spending 6 months perfecting this design, like spending 6 months really figuring out what the brand is, what the logo is, giving yourself the time, the space, not putting it on like a tiny short timetable, not rushing that process. But the product is so important. And so the development, like, creating that minimum viable product, on one hand, like you could have a, you know, a simple tool that exists that's a great idea, but if it's not, if the UI isn't great, if the design isn't great, like, yeah, it might not really prove the potential that it actually has. So I want to caveat that with saying, like, it was the minimum viable product done as well as possible. And I think if I had just taken a binocular and, you know, put a really simple design on it that kind of was just a cylindrical tube and made them orange, it might have been a lot harder. It might have been a lot harder. It might not have actually stuck. So I think that those leverage points of like design are really important to get right, because I think where we're going with this is you create that, you know, viable product, whatever you want to call that. You create the thing, and then you really do have to just let it go and observe and monitor and try to look for those signs that this does have a product market fit. Because without that, you really are facing an uphill battle. And without that, yeah, it might make more sense to stay in a salaried job and not wake up at 3 a.m. with anxiety.
Yeah, tell me about it. You know, having developed products in China and selecting colors for silicone, why, and with your design aesthetic and visually separating it from sort of a lot of the black incumbents that are on the market, how are you selecting colors? Because the other thing too is that you have your minimum order quantity, and adding more colors can be pretty expensive, particularly if it's manufactured overseas. So what was your process for, you know, color selection? It seems trivial, but like the number of different color chips and debates that we've had internally on what new colors we're going to launch, it is a crazy debate that, you know, can have a lot of circular logic and go back and forth.
The product design itself, again, it was not done with a committee. It was really me proving to myself, you know, following that design course at Loyola Marymount and then creating a great speaker at Boombotics, I was always left with this question of, are you just a one hit wonder? Did you just make one thing? Is that all you're capable of? Like, and so I've always kind of been faced internally with this thing of trying to prove to myself, this imposter syndrome that I'm an industrial designer. And so this was really, this design process was one where I took a few inspirations, but just sort of locked in on this design and really spent a lot of time, you know, sitting with my 3D printer, perfecting it. And that was done, you know, actually I would bring prototypes out to these coffee outside bike rides on Friday mornings, and they're 3D printed shells on top of like a existing binocular. And one friend looked at it and he goes, yeah, this is all right. I mean, it's kind of slippery on the top. And I got, you know, and that was all. And then I took it to another friend that later that day, and he's like, dude, this thing isn't that cool. And at that point I was like, okay, I think I got to change something up. So, you know, change the ridges on the top to turn 90 degrees and create a bit more of a grippy surface. And it turns out that really, it was like the crux of the product, like going from good to great. And then launched with black and launched with this color called Flat Earth that was originally, you know, I had the factory go buy some Vans in China and go color match the base of the Vans gum sole to the bring it to the rubber factory. And those were the first two colors we launched with. And then realized like people like dug the color story. And so, you know, I do have a little bit of a background just caring about colors, and had a great kind of friend at Santa Cruz Bicycles help me out during the Boombotics days on choosing color and color strategy. And so, you know, that was something I kind of, actually, to be honest with you, realized we wanted to add to the color line, chose about 4 or 5 Pantones. And this was like mid COVID, chose 4 or 5 Pantones, and then got like 4 or 5 samples of each color, then chose like the orange and the blue and the yellow after making like a lot of different ones. Because keep in mind, yeah, Nox basically was a 2019 launch, and that fall of 2019 was that kind of objective year of selling them on online, just simple photos, simple brand, simple website, and measuring whether or not there was a return on ad spend. In 2020, that was right when I was trying to transition, starting to transition into this, you know, full gas. And that was when COVID hit and the factory shut down. And that was also right when the outdoor boom was taking place. And so, yeah, that was, I think, adding color. I realized that the color story was just what no other brand in the space was doing. And so it just made sense to create a lot of colors. And luckily that was just me and a Pantone book and no committee process.
What I wondered too, if part of that was the learnings from Boombotics, where it's about being cool. It's like these are accessories, but you want to wear them at all times. And I think I remember hearing another podcast you did that's like, traditionally, if you had giant black binoculars, you were kind of a creepo. Like, I'm imagining somebody in, you know, tube socks and cargo pants outside of a house with a pair of binoculars and a creepy mustache. And you're like, no, dude, hold on. So I think bright, fun colors as an accessory makes a ton of sense.
Totally. I mean, it really helps. Perhaps, and you might be able to really agree with this, is it helps to create something like for yourself. and in the case of, in the case of Knox, like I knew who the customer was. I knew what they wanted because it was me and my friends, millennial aged, active, outdoor, educated, and binoculars are awesome. What a cool tool. There's no batteries. There's no sizes. They let you enhance the world around you. It's a visual presence. It connects you with nature. Like, it's just such a cool product. And the way that these brands presented their products was just so far off that it almost feels like this felt kind of punk. You know, it was like punk in the sense of being like, screw the establishment. We're going to do this our way. And yeah. Our colors sell unlike any other colors I've ever seen. At Boombotics, we made black and six other colors. And black's most business portfolio, color portfolios, there's one bestseller and it's black. And it sells like 52% of that product SKU. And then the rest of the six are divided as little thin slices of the pie. And for Knox, it's an equal color split. And I think that goes to choosing really good colors, right? We're not like in the Crayola, you know, starter pack. We're choosing some like deep Pantones, man. We're deep in the Pantone books, but they sell really well. And I think that goes back to having a color strategy and understanding different personas and who's buying the product. And you're right. People do wear these on the outside of them. They want to stylize. They want colors that speak to them. And, you know, if they're buying one for their uncle for Christmas, they might buy one in kind of our cypress green that's a little deeper, but a sophisticated green tone.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Like, that reminds me of the Henry Ford Model T. It's like you can get in any color as long as it's black. But then also, yeah, what you said about, you know, designing for yourself is very much like the Rick Rubin school of creativity. Like, as a producer, and I've listened to his 60 Minutes episode and a lot of his podcasts, he's like, you know, going off of what he likes and trusting his instincts. And, you know, if you have good taste and you have good instincts, you know, be ruthless and having full control over the design. And then, you know, as you did, you have your hypothesis. And, you know, you validate it. So I think that's very interesting that, like, you have ultimate control on the design that you want to create, and don't do design by committee.
Exactly. Don't do design. If you have that intuition, I mean, especially when it comes to that initial thing, like, don't do design by committee. And, you know, you really need to, if you are going to be a challenger brand, if you're going to be a startup and an entrepreneurial take on something, like, you're either inventing something from new that's never existed, which is extremely, extremely hard because you have to figure out a whole communication strategy to tell people what it is. But again, in our case, you know, the design, the aesthetic, the brand, the logo, the color, that all did kind of come from understanding who I am and who my friends are. And yeah, exactly. Rick Rubin's recent book is great.
Yeah, I highly recommend. So you talked about manufacturing in China. You spent a lot of time there. And your timing sounds pretty rough when it's like initial launch in 2019 and then hit with 2020. Like, how stressful was it manufacturing during COVID? And then also you have sort of like the pause for Chinese New Year and then COVID on top of that. Were there horror stories and setbacks, and sort of how did you sort of navigate those waters?
Well, I mean, this goes into, I think, entrepreneurship in itself, but it was pretty scary. It was pretty scary. I mean, I don't think we've really revisited what COVID was. There was a point there where it was like, who knows if, who cares about business? But, ultimately, one, Chinese New Year is awesome because China, the people there work so damn hard. I mean, they really, they work Saturdays every day, every week of the year. They really do. It's an incredibly hardworking country. And so the fact that they give themselves a break is like more power to them. You know, the French have a French New Year. It's the month of August. So, you know, the Chinese New Year thing, it's good. I mean, people can be with their families that work themselves silly otherwise. So I'm a huge fan of just the concept of it. I think, you know, Chinese culture is an amazing culture. And anyhow, going back to it, yeah, it was scary. But what it was there was an increased demand. And then there was and China was pretty weird with COVID. Like, they didn't shut their factories down. But there was this outdoor boom, and binoculars were part of it. And all of us, and we're at a factory that manufactures for a lot of other big players in the market, and they saw their demand go up. And so all of a sudden the capacity at the factory was super limited. And our lead times, which had been about 60 days to begin with, doubled. And then they doubled again. And then they doubled again. And it was really at this point when I had realized, again, solo product design entrepreneur, getting the brand going, no design by committee, no convincing anyone. I'm like, this is the thesis. But once we realized, like, okay, there was a 6 months of sales data. I did bring on a friend who had been working in this he had been working for a solar tech company, and you know, wore four hats there at the startup. And I was like, hey, it would be great if you could come in and help me out with just the accounting. How'd we do last year? And I had been meaning to, it was one of those to-do list items that I just never got to. And so he came on and started chatting. And at this point, he had been working for the Tom Steyer campaign. That campaign had kind of ended, and he was able to dedicate more time to Knox. And then we were starting to build out a financial model. And that was right when COVID hit. And we ended up both moving up to Tahoe out of San Francisco, just because it was just a little too nerve-wracking to stay in like a small apartment there. And knowing how that city operates, it's great. I mean, they did really well from a COVID perspective, but it was a lot. Like, you couldn't play tennis. Like, people expected you to bike with a mask on. It was a little much. So we moved up here, and David ultimately joined as a co-founder in kind of a business, finance and operation side of the thing, which allowed me to really focus on sales, product, marketing, brand. And so I had, years of experience managing factories, and was able to kind of, David was able to just understand the ropes of it. And what we did is we forecasted our lead times grew. We forecasted what we could do on, our ad spend. We started producing against that. It was a big gamble, but we really worked with the factory closely to commit to a production schedule 12 months out. With all this uncertainty, we were committing to the schedule. And then ultimately on the marketing side, we were like out of product. So we would be able to tell customers, all right, we have a batch coming. We shifted to a monthly production cadence. We were able to tell customers online, like, hey, we have a batch coming in May, and, there's going to be 200 greens, so you can pre-order one. And luckily, the brand was kind of hot. We had just been featured in Outside Magazine's Buyer's Guide. We had been very communicative on social media. Great, you know, we'd get these Facebook ads where a customer would be like, these are garbage. I don't trust anyone other than Vortex. And would be like, all right, these are like, you know, we brought like a real personal touch. And I think we really just focused on customer trust, that we were a real brand in the States. We're not just some Instagram binocular thing. And that trust allowed us to basically pre-book our DTC production. So we would sell most of our monthly productions before they landed and would tell the customers, hey man, they're shipping August 22nd, and would ship them on August 19th. And like, customers would write reviews just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe these guys. They're the real deal. And it was so cool. I mean, it was nerve-wracking, but we just figured transparent communication, and, you know, measured, we did our best. I mean, we didn't have any monstrous COVID delays until years down the road. So we were able to deliver what we said we would. And we, you know, had a shipment land on, I think, December 16th, and we were able to get them all out and landed in people's mailboxes for Christmas. So
you mean it arrived on the 16th, and then that is incredible. I mean, what's really hard is forecasting. Like, forecasting is just unbelievable. And if you can hit those deadlines, credit to you. And, but you talk about gamble. I mean, this is, I would imagine, very much a gift giving product. I mean, it's the perfect price point. Like, I'm already going to use it as stocking stuffers this year. But man, if you promise something for Christmas and you don't deliver, like, hell hath no fury. Like, angry customers, man, that say, hey, this was a gift. I have battle wounds for that. So that must have been some sleepless nights.
It was something. I mean, we shout out to our original warehouse, female owned independent warehouse in San Francisco, Nuna, Helena Noonan. She, like, we owe her so much for being such a dependable partner at this point in the business. And if you are looking for a warehouse, certainly Nunico is one.
Dude, our 3PL in Dallas, I'm not going to say who they are, but they refuse to ingest any inventory from like Black Friday, from even before Black Friday to the shipping cutoffs. So like, I mean, we had a shipment come from China, and we paid like $40,000 for like a 40-foot shipping container, like crazy amount. Sat off the coast of California, missed Black Friday, Cyber Monday, finally got to the factory, and they're like, yeah, we can't ingest this. We're too busy.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, I mention it was a independently owned warehouse? Like, it's a small operation, and we outgrew it pretty quickly. But, and yeah, our new warehouse that we transferred to, nightmare. Yeah. Brutal. Like, we're moving out of them currently. But, I mean, again, like, and I had worked with her at Boombotics. There was a working relationship, and, you know, she was able to allow the pallets to come in, and she hired, I mean, it's amazing. She employs, like, you know, a lot of artists in San Francisco, people who just need enough money to kind of keep getting by, and, you know, brought in, like, we coordinated the shipment. She brought in the A team of like 10 people, and they just blitzed it, like, over the weekend. Packing, shipping, those things went out Monday. And get this, we made little printed, risograph printed Christmas cards that were like, hey, hope you have a great Christmas, like, from Knox, because we didn't think that they were actually going to make it. That was our little insurance policy, like, just to give someone a little, like, you know, put that under the tree instead of the Knox. But instead, we actually had a few customers go, what the hell, man? You ruined Christmas. You gave the secret away because your little card came in the mail. But it turned out they all landed. I mean, they all, with the exception of like, you know, a half a percent, like, they all landed under the Christmas tree. And yeah, that was an incredible year.
That's giving me anxiety just thinking about that, man. What's the name of the warehouse, and shout out? Are they still in business?
Shout out Nunaco, Nonaco. And, you know, they're really designed for your business. You know, once you've kind of proven you have a thing, and you're spending money on ads, and it's a DTC focused warehouse. limited capacity. I mean, I don't, they might be at their capacity currently, but just it was really helpful to have that relationship and you know, get that level of support. And then eventually when we shifted into doing more of our business in the wholesale fashion, we had to move. But you know, you move in, like, she didn't have a policy of SLAs and expectations and this and that, but it was just, it was like better than you can imagine in that sense of just being a reliable partner that could really understand what we wanted. So yeah, we got lucky that year. And
yeah.
And so 2020 was just, you know, we launched 6 new colors that year. And it was, I mean, mid 2020, it was scary times. So yeah.
Yeah. And that was so hard about that time because there was like K recoveries. Like there was one of my former business partners sells Japanese toilets online, like with no toilet paper. And so they saw the massive boom of like the great toilet paper run of 2020. So like in some cases you're going to have higher demand than you've ever had ever, but like your logistics are all slowed down. I'm also kind of skeptical of certain 3PLs. Like I would advise entrepreneurs, particularly in D2C, if you have a limited number of SKUs, do it yourself to start with. You have full control over it with SKU labs and a printer and
just with Shopify built in.
Even Shopify plugged in. It's like we needed a 3PL to handle our international orders, and like it was really complex because we had a massive Kickstarter campaign and we had to ship to like 85 countries, and that was complicated and expensive. But like now once it's steady state and you're doing a handful of like order fulfillments, I'm like, find a way to do it yourself, even if it's like, it's not super complicated. I mean, Q4 staffing is always hard, but the tools now with, you know, SKU Labs, ShipStation, Shopify, I mean, a lot of it's been optimized that like, it's, you should think long and hard, and it's a giant area of cost savings, I think. And if you get a bad
Yeah, absolutely.
Not fun.
And exactly. And when you are getting your business going, like, and you haven't necessarily proven that you can sell for, you know, you can sell to 1,000+ customers through Facebook ads with a favorable return. You know, yeah, definitely do it yourself. I always thought it was funny. To be honest, the way Knox had unofficially launched is a good friend of mine, Bernard, runs the online magazine Acquire Mag. And I had emailed him, you know, before we launched and said, hey man, do you mind just taking a look at this? What do you think? I'm doing new binoculars. And he responded the next day. And I had a targeted launch of like August 27th, but he responds the next day and he goes, oh man, these are cool. I just posted them. I'm like, what? So he posts them, and then all of a sudden word.com and some other like bottom feeder type blogs picked up his post. They all linked back to the website. Luckily there was some, you know, the website worked, it could collect money. And, you know, on my way to work, I would be slapping labels on the boxes ship on their own, but I would just drop them off in the UPS store on the way to work. And it was enough to kind of, you know, get the thing going. Because yeah, it's true. You don't really want to like build. That's kind of the thing. I think you do want to build a minimum viable business. Mm-hmm. So I kind of critiqued minimum viable product. Build the viable product, but build a minimum viable business. Don't get lost. Don't make a launch video. Don't hire a warehouse if you haven't started selling stuff already. Like, don't write a business plan. Make a website, make an Instagram, have a product page, have good photography, have your thing, and that's it. That's all you need, the minimum viable business. And so, yeah, going back to it, ship your own stuff.
I'm trademarking that term right now, minimum viable business. I love it. That's incredible wisdom right there. And as someone who's launched businesses and new products, do that 100%. Couldn't agree more. So with that, let's jump into rapid fire and bring this to a close. So real quick, what's your favorite business book?
Favorite business book? You know, I want to go to that Rick Rubin book that he just came out with, The Creative Act, A Way of Being. I feel like that's kind of like, that's the first half. And then the second half is The Founder's Mentality. which is like, yeah, you build a thing, you ship it. Now we have an office here in Lake Tahoe. We have 5 employees. We need to motivate the team. We need to have, you know, unified visibility. So the founder's mentality, and then the Rick Rubin book on sort of before that.
Awesome. Marrying creativity and running businesses. Which D2C brands do you look up to? Is there one we should check out?
I'm like a bad consumer.
Just stay like, hey, I'd like my products. That's totally fine.
I like my stuff. And to be honest, I'm like, I don't really buy too many things outside of skis and bikes. I like Armada skis, and Jensen USA is a online bike shop that has it's just really reliable, great customer service. But again, you know, there are brands I look up to in the DTC space. There are a lot of design led brands. There's like Away Travel. There's this cooking brand that I recently came across that Larry Marcus and Jay-Z also invested in. That's pretty impressive. But sorry, I'm drawing a blank there.
No, it's all good. So skiing and mountain biking, what's your favorite ski resort? Is it somewhere in Lake Tahoe?
Yeah, Alpine Meadows here, part of Palisades, Tahoe. It's where I currently live. And it's been really great because living here, you get the time to actually ski every single possible vector, every run, every rock. Like, it's been really cool to be able to fully understand the mountain and know every little nook and cranny. We're 3D printing topographic maps. You know, it's been really awesome to be able to ski here. Yeah, and I like Jackson Hole.
Yeah.
Jackson Hole is great.
Shout out Travis Rice. I got to do that with Blackcomb, 127 days. I knew Blackcomb like the back of my hand.
Oh man.
That's great. Awesome, Chris. Well, we're going to be mindful of time. Thank you for all your wisdom and making the time. I'm encourage people to check out Knox Provisions, spelled NOCSProvisions.com. And hopefully a lot of people that love the outdoors and want some good gifts for Q4, check out the website. I'm definitely going to be ordering some. I'm actually a birder too. We didn't even talk about birding. We'll save that for another time. But keep on rocking, and I appreciate you making the time.
Yeah. Thank you, Gavin. Thank you. I feel like I learned a little bit more about myself in talking about this with such great questions. So yeah, that minimum viable business. Don't make an about you video. That's hubristic.
The minimum viable business. That sounds like a business school class. Let's start pitching it to different schools now.
Totally. Cool, man. Well, awesome. I'm so glad to connect. Thank you again for your time here. Excited to be on this, and we'll be in touch.